Elise Glink joins us now, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Hope you had a good weekend, Elise. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, John. It was lovely. Great weather we're having, huh?
Yeah, this would be a marquee weekend for Chicago. Cubs and Sox, air and water show. If you were indoors, it was the Olympics. If you were outdoors, the weather was pleasant. It was a nice time to be in this part of the woods, wasn't it?
No, it does. I love, you know, spring, summer, and fall in Chicago. It is fantastic.
And one of these things is does not belong. okay, so just since we're all in a cheery mood here, you actually wanted to start talking about consumers' expectations about inflation. What's the word out there?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Consumers, when they look out, think to themselves, you know what? Inflation has been a problem, but going forward over the next 3 years, I don't think it's going to be so much of a problem. And that's really important because when consumers talk about what's going on with them, almost universally, you know, like 60% of people feel like we're in a recession right now. But when they look forward, they see inflation as being less of a problem in coming years. And what we think is so important about that, and this is a new study today that was released by the New York Federal Reserve, is that having, you know, the expectation that things are going to get better often has a way of turning into reality, right? Imagination is, you know, can actually play out. And so consumers are expecting inflation to be at just 2.3%, and that is the lowest in the history of the survey going back 11 years.
How much stock do you put in surveys like that? How important are they? How telling are they?
Well, I think you have to look at a trend line, right? You can't take any one of these surveys, you know, at any point in time, and they can tell you any story you want to imagine about them, right? They think it'll be less of a problem, which means that today it's a huge problem, right? But I think that trend lines are showing that people are starting to get a little bit more confident about the economy, even as they feel for themselves that things are expensive and prices are out of control. So that's kind of an interesting thing that I think economists in general are trying to reconcile right now.
Maybe people are at an expensive as the new normal, and just hopefully it doesn't get expensiver so you don't feel it all over again. But if I may, my answer to the question is, I know it matters, but I'm not always sure that it should so much. What the consumer expectation is about something. Ask me what I think inflation is going to be a year from now. I don't know. And my opinion of it, or even my feeling about it, I don't think should matter that much. And yet we often hear these kinds of surveys reported on shows like this. And I'm not exactly sure what box to put them in, Elise.
Yeah, it's a good point, John. I mean, I think the fact that you think that inflation is going to go down may mean that you're more willing to keep spending,
well,
to not
that
hold
matters
money so tightly.
Yeah, sure, sure. So, right. So, however ill-informed my belief is, that might yet govern my spending or my actions, and therefore that does matter, right?
I think it does. And it's certainly in an economy that many people call, you know, like we're the golden economy of the world right now. We're growing. We've had, you know, quarter after quarter of job growth. We still have job growth. We have relatively low unemployment right now. You know, a lot of the world would like to be in our shoes. And so if consumers think that things are going to continue to get better, and inflation, which has been the number one problem now since the pandemic began, and they think it's going to be less of a problem, that feels like it's another chink of good news that's plunking, you know, keeping the wall up.
And to be clear, we are not in a recession right now, right?
No, we're not. And that's another thing that's sort of interesting, is that you've got a lot of consumers, you know, almost 60%, that think that we've been in a recession since March of last year. So like a year and a half. But we are absolutely not in a recession. We've continued to expand the economy. We don't, you know, a recession is when you've got a significant decline in economic activity that usually goes across two quarters plus some other stuff. That's the last time that happened was 4 years ago. And so the fact that people think we're in a recession, I think, has to do with this idea that they think that they personally are struggling, so everybody else must be struggling as well.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. The Fed hasn't done anything with interest rates. Presumably they'll go down, and that'll begin to ease up the log jam. So what's the attitude out there among home buyers these days, Elise?
Oh, just total frustration, boy. And you're seeing it come out in homes that come on the market, and there immediately are just a ton of offers for a decent property. On the North Shore, you're seeing homes sell again in a day, even as teardowns at prices way in excess with multiple offers. So we're seeing, even in Chicago, multiple bids in certain neighborhoods, Lincoln Park, Lakeview, the North Shore, the western suburbs. People are finding that when they have a house, they're going out there. But for a lot of people, it's just frustrating. And so Fannie Mae's surveys, you know, which they do every single month, 17% say it's a good time to buy. 65% say it's a good time to sell.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
People are, you know, most people just think that they want to stay out of this market if they can. The biggest issue for people is you've got still over 80% of homeowners with a mortgage who have an interest rate of less than 4%. And the current interest rates are at 6.5% or 7%.
Do
so you're not going to trade
again,
that out,
Liz.
Right?
Say that again.
So more than 80% of people who have mortgages have them at less than 4%.
Well, that explains just about everything. In fact, so 65% say it's a good time to sell, meaning that it's interesting, though, that if you were to put your house on the market and give up your 3% mortgage for a 6% one, it's a good time to sell, meaning that there are people out there who are willing to assume a 7% mortgage themselves and buy your house. Most folks think it's a good time to sell. I get it. There's not that much inventory. Everything you just said. But isn't it interesting that the people that are shy about getting out of that good mortgage know that there are people that are willing to take on that kind of a mortgage to get into their house?
Yeah, it's interesting who's trying to buy homes and where they're trying to do it.
Assuming they're not paying cash, but I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
No, although, John, and I don't have that number right in front of me, but I remember seeing in the last couple of weeks is another, you know, survey or study that showed that the percentage of people buying with full cash has actually increased. So what's happened is, you know, if you've been in your house a long time, like you and I have talked about before, when we sell, we don't have very much mortgage left typically. And so we have cash from the sale. We can pay cash for a smaller new place, right? That was that whole downsizing thing. So more and more people are coming forward with cash, but you also have investors, real estate investors, hedge funds, or just individual people who also have cash, and they're going in and they make an offer that's a cash only. And that is also frustrating for home buyers, because if you're a home buyer who's a first time home buyer and you're scraping together your down payment, which is typically the biggest obstacle to buying, and now you're trying to qualify with the mortgage and you make an offer, you typically will have a mortgage contingency in that offer, meaning that you need to know that you're going to get approved and the home is going to appraise out in value. But if I come in and I just am cash only, the seller, even if he gets a little bit less, knows that deal is going through no problem. So you really can add frustration on top of frustration for home buyers who need a mortgage right now.
It almost sounds like ticket scalping. That is, if a hedge fund or somebody's buying up properties with cash, knowing that the market is so tight, they'll be able to now resell them with no intention of moving themselves in there to somebody else for even more. That inflates the market, but it's not the typical driver. It's not families fighting for it. It's investors just pushing the price up, right?
Yeah, but I would say to you also that the investors are not looking to flip right now. Like, they're really not flipping. What they're doing is they're holding because rents are going up and the rents are generating a decent amount. And so in the Great Recession 15-ish years ago, when millions of homeowners were, you know, out of their houses and going into foreclosure, you know, hard to imagine now when we had way more homes than the number of people who could buy them. You know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had all these homes on their hands, and they went to hedge funds and they said, why don't you guys buy these homes for a few years and rent them out, and then you can sell them and you'll make some money. And what they found is that rents went up so much and it became so profitable, they held on to all those homes. all those homes came out of the market of homes available to sell. They haven't come back yet.
What's the deal with the commissions? That was the big story this spring and last winter, and isn't that supposed to do some sort of switcheroo here?
Oh, yeah. It's gone into effect. It goes into effect August 17th, which is later this week, I think.
5 days from today.
That's right. And so the typical buyer's agent is now earning, in advance of this, 2.5% in commission, and that's declined from around close to 3% since the settlement with the National Association of Realtors was announced in March. Redfin is reporting that, that's come down. And so, but because home prices are going up, you know, agents are still earning an average of $15,000 per deal. And so you're seeing the percent decline, but the total amount stay the same or go up. So expensive.
Yeah, that's the seller's agent is getting $15,000 a deal.
Actually, no, that's the buyer's agent. So what's happened, the big news with this settlement is that now buyers have to be responsible for paying or arranging for their agents to get compensation. It's not automatically flowing from the seller. But in practice, it's still flowing from the seller.
Mm.
So I personally, and I've written about this, John, I don't think anything's going to change here in terms of how people get compensated, but buyers are now having to sign new paperwork, sellers are signing new paperwork, and agents are having to be much more careful about how they advertise the commission split that's available.
Well, and I think it's probably just momentarily awkward.
Yeah.
Because in the past, you just say 6%. Well, can you do 5.5? Can you do 5? Maybe, you know. But then you don't typically say, wow, Claudia, you're going to get $18,000 for what we've done the last couple. And the way properties are moving so quickly right now, I could see how some of the buyers would wonder if they do need to compensate their agent that much, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would suggest that anybody who's living in a hot neighborhood, try selling yourself. Even if you pay a half commission, if you pay the buyer's agent's commission or you discount your price at the end of the day enough to compensate for that, you're still going to be ahead, and you may sell your house in a couple of weeks. If you don't, you can always hire an agent.
If my friend George, who's an agent, is listening, I hope I didn't damage our friendship now. Feel free to tell me what I said that was wrong, George. Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Let's talk next week, Elise.
Sounds good, John.
Jim Dahlke joins us again, the Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. Hope you're doing well. How are you today?
Hey, John, doing great. Thanks for having me.
You have a nice weekend. Did you watch the Olympics?
Yeah, I'm kind of sad to see it go. I don't know what we're going to watch. We got football season's got to get here soon because I was really loving the Olympics over the last couple weeks.
It was the sort of thing that was a sufficiently nice distraction that I thought, can't they just play until November? Can't we just ask Simone, hey, would you do that for 4 more months? You know, could we maybe get Snoop Dogg in the pool, do something to just keep it going, because it really was fun, wasn't it?
It was. We should just run some of this again, you know, do the 200 twice, you know?
I know. Well, particularly since this is a tangent here, but I'll finish this thought. Think about the men's high jump. They were jumping about 7 feet, 8 inches, I think it was. Draw a line on the wall in your kitchen there and imagine running up and jumping over that with no aid. And the American and the Danish, I think it was, high jumper were tied after they both missed 3 times on the last bar. And they said, okay, we'll give you both a gold or you can have a jump off. And then we'll lower it a little bit and see if somebody can clear that. But now one of you is going to get the silver. And they said, we'd rather do that. I am not one of those guys. I would have shared the gold. What would you have done, Jim?
Yeah, I'm with you. Moral of the story, when offered a gold medal, take the gold medal. And that would have given us the outright gold lead, too. So, yeah, missed opportunity there.
Oh, now that you mention it. Yeah, and if somebody says to you, hey, did you win a gold at the Olympics? You could say yes. And then you don't have to say, but this other guy did, too. You don't have to say that. You could just say, yeah, I won a gold. Yeah, because you did. Okay, let's talk a little bit about sports robotics. What's the story there?
Yeah, this is a sports robotics startup called Monarch. They actually launched out of Northwestern University back in 2015. They have created a high-tech robotic, essentially jugs machine, if you see on the football field. Teams will put footballs in these jugs machines and kind of take the quarterback out of the equation and allow receivers to work on their hand-catching skills. Their robotics machine is basically a souped-up version of that. It's called the Seeker, and it allows teams to program different routes for their receivers to run, put in this machine, and then it fires the football off so they can work on different route trees and different plays. And it just allows for more flexibility than your traditional kind of jugs machine on the football field. These guys launched out of Chicago, out of Northwestern University, back in 2015. They left for Iowa as they continue to build their business. They've gotten this thing in front of more than 40 college football programs, including Notre Dame, Ohio State, Michigan, Oregon. They are now back in Chicago. So brought the business back to Chicago. Got a new headquarters down on Goose Island, where they're kind of doing the final assembly of these machines. It's also where teams and athletes can come through and test out the technology themselves. And Serve says that they've tripled their revenue over the last year, so growing quickly here and bringing technology back around to Chicago.
Well, we're getting machines to do everything, including throwing passes to receivers in practice. Is it the two spinning wheels and the ball goes in the middle?
That's right, with a touch screen in between. And so really allowing teams to program different routes and then keep data on that too, right? So how well receivers are running different routes and kind of creating these digital playbooks. And so, some really high-tech football technology right here in Chicago.
And by the way, one last thing about that. Are they actually manufacturing the machines in Chicago?
Yeah, the final assembly is done in their new 3,700-square-foot facility here in Goose Island.
Yeah, over by Goose Island. Boy, that I want a facility next to Goose Island. There's another company called WHEN. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, WHEN, W-H-E-N. Startups launch all the time based on kind of a trend in the market, what's going on in the market, what problems are trying to be solved. You know, one problem that WHEN is solving for are layoffs. Of course, lots of layoffs are happening in the tech sector. All different kinds of businesses. And, they recently raised about $4.6 million in seed funding to offer a new tool to companies who are going through rounds of layoffs. Essentially, what they do is they offer different companies health insurance plans from places like healthcare.gov. So their exiting employees can compare benefits among competing plans and find some cheaper options. What they say is COBRA plans, which are the sort of the traditional plans that companies offer folks who are laid off, on average, cost about three times more than those for active employees. And what they found is that when companies are using their service, one employer saved about over $1 million, and the fired employee saved over $225 per month on their premium. So basically, what they're doing is allowing folks to kind of shop around and have a little bit better transparency and access to lower cost health care plans when they get laid off from a business, and allowing those businesses to save a little money on their end as well.
Yeah, that's a monster trying to find health care when you've been laid off, and then the option is something that's insanely expensive. Is this AI? Is it, you talk to the machine and say, okay, I'm getting laid off, or we're going to lay off somebody. What's the best health coverage for them?
There may be some AI elements of this, but one element of this that's interesting as well is it's not just health care. It's also 401k rollovers, also career coaching and resume building. So it's kind of a suite of products, but you could certainly imagine that AI could play a role in this down the road.
What's the Great Lakes Venture Capital Association?
Yeah, this is a new group that's really trying to better connect the venture capital activity across the Midwest, specifically here in the Great Lakes. And so, yeah, this group, the Great Lakes Venture Capital Association, just formally launched earlier this month. Really, the goal is to kind of connect the top VC firms here in the middle part of the country. So, specifically here in Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. The West Coast has these advantages compared to the Midwest, just how close everything is in the Valley. And even in LA, you can kind of get everywhere very quickly. There's well built over years, and kind of the activity that's happening here in the Midwest is a little bit more disparate. And with this group here is just looking to better kind of connect these efforts. So you can imagine that, venture capitalists in Ohio will be able to better share potential startup deals with investors here in Illinois and in Michigan, and sort of bringing the collective you know, muscle from across the Midwest and the Great Lakes region, all with one organization. So interesting effort here, just launched, and they're hoping to kind of create these sort of running events where they'll be able to all kind of get in the same room and you know, share a little bit of brain power and potentially some startup deals.
Yeah, it's amazing. There are people out there. I not infrequently marvel at this sort of thing. These people you and I don't know, and they're out there thinking these kind of thoughts and marshaling these kinds of resources right here in the Chicago area. Talk about Velocity Catalyst Fund.
Yeah, Velocity Catalyst Fund. This is a new $50 million venture fund led by a longtime Chicago Tech veteran, Desiree Vargas Wrigley. She's a startup founder herself. She's most recently the executive director at TechRise, which is a pitch competition that helps get the cash in the hands of underrepresented minority founders. And this is a new endeavor for her, a $50 million fund that she's going to not only invest into early stage startups here in Chicago, but also emerging venture funds themselves. So it'll invest directly into new VC funds. One thing that we saw in the 2020, 2021, lots of new venture firms launched. These emerging funds were led by kind of one or two folks kind of launching these sort of small shop VC funds. These popped up all over the place as interest rates were very, very low, and it was easier to start new funds. As interest rates have gotten higher, it's been trickier for those folks, and especially if they're looking to raise new funds, it's been a more difficult experience for them raising new capital to invest in more startups. And so what this new fund from Desiree Vargas Wrigley will do is not only invest in startups, but also invest in those new emerging VC funds. So they'll themselves be able to invest into more startups in Chicago.
I haven't thought about that from your perspective as much as we talk about interest rates here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. But if the rates come down half, three quarters of a point this year, certainly that much next year, is that going to put more money in the tech sector?
Yeah, it certainly could. And it will, we're going to have to see how that plays out. But as money is easier to come by, it's going to be better for the investors in the tech sector and potentially better for the startups as well. But I don't know that we're going to see a huge measurable shift. That may take more time. Things are still trickier today for startups than they were 4 years ago. But, one thing is for certain is that startups that, have sound businesses and are kind of on a path to,
right,
to hyper growth are raising good rounds.
They'll be able to borrow the money maybe more easily. But in fact, venture capitalist dollars are that's not borrowed money usually anyway, is it?
Correct. But, where they're getting their money from, right, from the limited partners that invest in those funds. And so it trickles down throughout kind of the ecosystem.
Jim Dahlke is the director of communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new ranking puts Chicago in the top five best locations for startups. Coworking Mag has determined its 2024 list by analyzing 108 U.S. cities across several metrics, including support system, available funding, setup cost, and availability of talent. The ranking says Chicago has the third biggest number of startup incubators and fourth highest number of accelerators. In 2023, Chicago had the seventh highest number of startups created with 34 launches. The city also has the sixth highest number of venture capital firms with 11 actively raising and distributing funding between 2019 and 2024. San Francisco took the top spot, followed by New York, Los Angeles, and then Seattle. Naming rights have been awarded for the temporary football stadium at Northwestern University. The Wildcats will play there while the new Ryan Field is being built. It'll be called Northwestern Medicine Field at Martin Stadium. The university agreed to a two-year agreement with Northwestern Medicine. It's one of the first naming rights deals in the U.S. as part of a new rule in college football allowing commercial sponsorships on the field. Terms of the agreement have not been disclosed. The new Ryan Field is set to be completed in 2026. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And we are 5 days into the Illinois State Fair, and one of the highlights for fairgoers is Piglets on Parade. No, not that kind of parade. More about the Piglets on Parade after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. There's never been a better time to see and even hold and cuddle with a baby pig. JoBeth Matley is an intern for the Illinois Pork Producers Piglets on Parade.
Yes, I'm the pork ambassador. I'm in charge of the Piglets on Parade.
Except there are no piglets parading, just a parade of people walking into the birthing center.
You walk in and you go on these mats that have disinfectant on it, so they disinfect your shoes. And then you can come in and grab some pig ears, a sticker, some educational stuff for kids. And then you come through and you see the baby pigs on their moms, and you get to pet one and get pictures with them.
A few days before the fair started, four very pregnant sows were brought into the birthing center, and
two litters that had 14, and then one had 16, and one had 15.
Wow, that's a lot, isn't it?
Yes, the average is anywhere from 8 to 12.
Are the sows able to feed all those babies?
Yes, actually they do.
Is there a nipple for every baby?
How many nipples?
Mm-hmm.
So one of them has like 17 or 18, and so does the other one. And then one has 12, so I took some of the babies so they can get more milk and move them to the other moms that have more nipples. And then the other one also has around 15.
Okay, baby pigs, just a couple of weeks old. Can we pick them up?
Yes.
And she says there's even a contest to guess the piglet's weight.
Look at the piglet and see what you think the weight is.
And how much do they weigh?
Well, the weight for the baby that I weighed last night was 3.4 pounds.
You can say hi to JoBeth, who's a sophomore studying ag at Lincoln Land Community College, at Piglets on Parade, which is located next to the Illinois Department of Agriculture tent. And if you can't make it, there's a live piglet cam. If you want to watch the piglets 24/7, you can find the link at WGNradio.com. Search for the business of food.
They just hang out all day and see the people.
On the food calendar, the Paris Olympics are done, but you can still celebrate with National Julienne Fries Day. The thin-cut shoestring fries date back to France in the 1700s. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
This is such a nice story. You may have heard about what the students from By the Hand Club did. We're going to tell you a little bit about that with Rodney Williams, the Director of Entrepreneurship and Economic Development, By the Hand Club for Kids. Rodney, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about the club first.
Well, By the Hand Club for Kids is a faith-based organization. We're a reading program located in the Austin community. Our program is dedicated to helping kids obtain abundant life, mind, body, and soul. We are connected with many of the local schools in our community, and you know, we allow kids to participate in this program by way of referrals from principals. We try to focus on the kids who need the help the most. So many times, the way kids actually come into the program, you know, they're needing just so much support, whether it's academic or just other obstacles that's preventing them to really being able to thrive and do well in school. And so we dedicate our time and efforts to not only helping the student, but just helping the family to turn things around.
Yeah, I suppose we should do everything we can to help every kid. Everybody benefits when we lift up anybody, but it sounds like these are the kids who might more easily fall prey to the clutches of gangs and violence and that sort of thing.
Well, absolutely. We are in one of those communities where, that's unfortunately the reputation of the Austin community. And so we're taking it upon ourselves to, change the narrative of how Austin is perceived, that, there are amazing students, that our future is in good hands, with the kids that we are connected to. And, we're just teaching them how to dream bigger than what they've seen and, the things that maybe their families have experienced over the last few years. So, we're optimistic and we believe that, we are headed in the right direction.
So you formed something called the Austin Harvest. What is that?
Well, Austin Harvest was dreamed up out of a time when things were really shutting down in the middle of the pandemic. Roughly July of 2020, we dared to gather kids who were just trying to process what a pandemic was. They were stuck at home doing virtual learning. They were losing family members left and right. So we did something called Peace Circles, where we invited the kids to come in and just give them a safe space to express themselves, try to talk out what they were seeing and things of that nature. And at the end of that, we had invited, the 15th District Police and Sam Acho and Athletes for Justice, just various people came just with the intention on hearing the hearts of the kids. And immediately after, we did a tour of our community, and this was right after the George Floyd killing, and you know, there was all the, you know, the looting and the rock, you know, things that were taking place in the community, and we saw just how devastated, you know, the community was as a result of things that were happening. We noticed at that time that we were actually in the middle of a food desert. We counted 23 liquor stores and only 2 to 3 grocery stores at that time. And that's when we knew we needed to do something different in our community. We needed to make, you know, things that were, you know, something simple as produce could change, you know, the health status of so many African Americans in this community who don't have a place to purchase, you know, fresh produce. And so one of the kids said, you know, they just made a statement, hey, what appears to be a luxury shouldn't be. This should be something that everybody should, you know, have the opportunity to, you know, to have access to without having to leave our community to get it. And so Austin Harvest, you know, we started with a 12-month program just to see how we could just give back to the community. And at the end of the 12 weeks, the community would not let us shut down. We literally started August of 2020, and they would not, I don't think we closed until a week before Christmas of that same year. And it was at that moment we knew we needed a year-round facility.
So now this year-round facility sells fresh produce and flowers for Austin residents.
Sir.
It encourages entrepreneurship by the kids, and it's providing not only just a good feeling and attitude among the kids, but a valuable service, a product that area needs. What can our listeners do? I just got a half a minute left, Rodney, but what can our listeners do to help you all?
Well, we have our ribbon cutting on tomorrow from 3 to 6. We're open to the public from 12 to 6 on Tuesdays on Tuesday and Thursday. We're open to the public. If they can just come by and just support what we're doing, it's not just good produce, it's affordable produce. And so, you know, if they just would come by and support our kids, let them know, hey, good job, that would be absolutely amazing. Our hours will be every week from Tuesday to Thursday, 12 to 6 p.m., you know, and so, you know, if they would love, you know, if they would stop by and just support the kids, you know, whether it's produce or flowers. Flowers, believe it or not, has been a huge seller for us over the last few years. So come stop by, get your bouquet or whatever the case may be. But we would love to see you guys take advantage of what we're doing and support the kids.
Buythehand.org/AustinHarvest. Buythehand.org. By the way, what's the location then of this?
We are at 423 North Laramie. 423 North Laramie.
Good luck to you. And Rodney, report back to us. Keep doing what
you're
doing.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Rodney Williams is the Director of Entrepreneurship and Economical Development.